Welcome to Intelligent Conversations. This podcast is about science, technology, and the impact they have on our everyday lives. Come join in the conversation. Here's your host, Professor Chance Glenn.
Okay, thank you, and welcome to yet another installment of Intelligent Conversations. As always, I'm your host, Chance Glenn. This week, I have a very special guest in the studio today, and we'll get a chance to speak with her in a second. But before we do, I want to let you know, as always, that Intelligent Conversations is a podcast that is available online. It's available at iTunes under Intelligent Conversations. I would love for you to go there to subscribe to the podcast and get the show every week as we produce it. I also would love for you to visit our website at ourintelligentconversations.com. There you can see a little bit more about our guests. You can see a little bit about me and what the show is all about. And you can see what we're doing and what's upcoming. You can also go back and see some of the old shows and download directly from the website. I also invite you to visit our Facebook page. There you can interact with us. Our Facebook is under Intelligent Conversations, so just search for us there, like us there, and do all the social media stuff that you can do. And we just have a good time there. You can interact with us and participate and just join the conversation. Finally, let me mention how you can help us to expand the show. On our website at Our Intelligent Conversations, we have an affiliate with Amazon.com. You can go there. All you have to do is go to our website, click on Amazon.com, and then do your regular online shopping. Christmas is here and all the other things are here. So go there and we'll get credit for whatever you do. It doesn't add anything to your shopping, but it helps us in such a great way. So that would be very, very helpful for us as we expand the show. And speaking of expansion, this show really is, I think, is an important one because it marks an expansion of the concept of the show. As I started, my particular comfort zone is in science and engineering and technology. However, I have interests very broadly, but the guest we have today was Dr. Mary Lynn Breaux. She is the Carolyn Werner Gannett Professor of Humanities at RIT. How are you doing, Carolyn?
I'm sorry.
Mary Lynn.
I'll take any name.
I focus too much on the... What is the Carolyn Werner Gannett Professor? Tell me about that. That's an endowed...
It's an endowed chair that was created, and again, oral memory has to serve here in oral history.
Yeah.
It was created in the early 70s and held usually year by year, sometimes by people who flew in and delivered lectures and flew out.
Right.
And I think the longest surviving chair, other than myself, is probably 2 or 3 years, and that's been recently. But this is the first time the chair has actually put up a series and events related to that series around the professorship.
So. Okay, well, we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. I want to talk more about you. All right, so let's find out a little bit about you. Let's go back to the point where, now, you're a professor in what is your discipline? What is your field?
My publications, Chance, have been in revisions of modernism. By that I mean feminist revisions, revisions of lone individualist modernists who are, my idea is that they're much more expansive than just lone individuals. So a lot of feminism.
Okay, so give me an example of some of the people you're talking about.
I've published a book, for example, on Sylvia Plath and her poetry, which has grown outside of the world of the word since my book in 81 pretty dramatically.
Yeah.
Women writing in exile all over the world, in addition of women writing in exile. Exile is, as you know, as much trauma as it is literal political exile.
Yeah. I'd be interested in hearing a little bit later your take on some of the transitions happening around the world, and particularly how it affects women. And do you see an emergence of women around the world? But let's hold on to that for a second. However, that's your background. Now, at some point, everybody I've talked to, there was at some point in their life where this, whether it was a calling or motivation or something that triggered their interest in the field that they find themselves.
Sure.
What was that for you?
Actually, it was the Jesuit priests in a university, St. Louis University.
Okay.
And yes, among others, I had to get up at 8 a.m. for a composition class with Father Aloysius Motherway. But those powerful gentlemen were very important in my life.
Hmm.
Before that, I was at a Catholic girls' high school, and I still stay in touch with those powerful women in my life.
Okay.
And they were, most of them, MAs and PhDs at a high school level.
Okay.
And
so powerful in what way? To you?
Intellectual.
Okay.
Very well educated.
Okay.
Knowledgeable about Latin, about philosophy, about the world. Not just cloistered.
And that impressed you at a high school age, that reached
it
you.
It dovetailed with the way I had been raised, which was not to be a hydra-headed academic, but to do everything, arts, sports.
My
parents were great diversifiers.
Okay, what sports did you do?
I actually water skied.
Oh, all right.
And did competitive slalom and jumping. I belonged to the Century Club, which meant I could jump 100 feet out from a ski jump. That's what's wrong with my knees today. and hit the water with metal-reinforced skis.
Wow.
And I did a lot of slalom, and
you
I grew up sailing.
Too much of that here.
No, I grew up sailing with my father, too.
Oh, wow. Nice.
So, and golf.
Okay.
A lot of golf.
Do you still play?
I don't. It's the one thing I don't do. Of course, I don't do ski jumping. Maybe I should try it,
Chance,
you know? But a lot of sports.
Well, you could do ski jumping around here on the snow. You could do snow skis.
With a pair of robotic knees or something, bionic knees. Sure.
So you were eclectic in your approach to life.
Absolutely.
This is kind of similar to myself. We were talking before we got on, and I'm interested in music. I'm also a fine artist. I grew up as a fine artist. I draw and paint, and I went to one of the fine arts schools as a in high school, my first couple of years in high school. I somehow found my way more into a technical field in engineering, electrical engineering, but those creative aspects were there, and also athletics, played basketball, all that kind of stuff. So I like to just do a lot of things and experience a lot of things. I wonder, is that it? Is it for you? Is it about experiencing a lot of things? Why do you have this draw to do different things?
Part of it is the curiosity to take risks.
Mm.
I had a very close, wonderful, small family, four of us.
Yeah.
And I never felt that I couldn't take a risk and then in some way, I mean, I could have failed massively in a number of things, and I'm sure I did. But I never felt the pain of that because I had such a supportive context from which I came.
Okay.
But I could take those risks, and I could be really curious about everything.
Okay, I get that. I get that. And I know that reaches a lot of people. It also, one of the, maybe you could say, drawbacks for me has been kind of fear appears to not focus on any one particular thing, but kind of,
you did on your art and your music, and I did too.
Yeah.
I gave a concert at age 17 with an accompanist on the piano, where I did, I call it Catholic girl piano, you know, waltz in A flat by Brahms and two and three part Bach inventions. But I gave about an hour concert, so that was pretty focused at age 17.
Sure.
Likewise with an art exhibit. They called it a one-man solo exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure you did those things too.
Yeah.
And yeah. It was in its own way a kind of focus, but nevertheless, a number of different talents that got developed in those years.
So it makes me wonder then what, this is a philosophical question, but I'm going to put it out there to you anyway. What do you think greatness is? What entails greatness? I think if you probably poll people, you say, who do you know is a great person?
Let's quote Steve Jobs on that one.
Yeah.
He abandoned the bureaucrats for the pirates, as he said.
Okay.
He preferred piracy.
Yeah.
Its ability to step outside that turf, that silo, that boundary that many people would reinforce for you, and to take the risk to explore, to be curious, to that is greatness, I think.
Okay. So then what matters? What matters? I mean, because you use Steve Jobs as a quotation example. So as a person, he was singularly focused on what his mission was as far as creating and building Apple and all the great products that have come out of it. I think he's a creator and a creative person, and that idea infused his company, and they built according to his philosophy. But it was in that particular thing, whether it's a iPhone or whatever. Okay, but what do you think matters? At the end of the day, does an iPhone matter? iPad, does that matter? What matters? So if I can just finish what I'm thinking, we spend this energy in life and we push things out and we do things and we accomplish things and all that. But what matters to you?
Well, always what you can bring back to better humanity. Always what you can do to help people of anything you've accomplished. If Steve Jobs was a perfectionist about something aesthetic on an iPad or one of his previous devices, and he was a taskmaster about that, and everybody thought, what is all this pettiness about? But he nevertheless created a product that enhanced, enlarged products, humanity. And that's what you want to do. You want to get away from the petty dramas of every day, your small little day-to-day gestures, and you want to build them large to help people.
Okay.
To bring something back to humankind.
Okay.
I'm sorry if that sounds too large and vague.
No, it does. It, because I think what it asks us to do is to figure that out. What is it that you can do, that you can add, to all people, but what can you do? What part can you play in doing that? And that's an important thing. I think, see, I'm an optimist, and I look at this time that we have in this age that we're in. I look at it as an opportunity for some change. And if our focus on important things, if it kind of changes from this commercial capital, get me stuff, and pile it up and collect it and all that, to thinking more about what's important for humanity, that would be nice. That's what I would like to see. I just wonder if there's an opportunity with all these shiftings of seismic activity and geopolitical things,
Chance, I think that any individual has to take some time with people they trust. Maybe it's alone, maybe it's in silence, maybe it's with people they trust, and really kind of kick back and say, where are we going? Where does this matter? Let's highlight the big things here, and let's make sure we're focusing on them. But that kind of deliberation, I guess I'd call it meditation or deliberation, at nodal points in our lives, is terribly important. Is this what I want to be doing?
Right.
What am I doing when I'm doing this?
Right.
It sounds so simple, but it isn't simple when you're caught up on a treadmill of every day.
Yeah. Well, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to take a break right here. When I come back, I want to kind of quickly get to what led you to become a professor. And then I want to talk about your work.
Sure.
And we can take that into that segment and into because actually in this part, we started talking about some of the things I wanted to talk about in the last segment.
Sorry.
So, no,
these
that's
conversations
good.
Conversations wander that
yeah,
way. Don't
yeah,
they?
That's good. That's what makes it good. So let's do that. And sorry. So this is Intelligent Conversations, and we'll be right back. Okay, we are back with Intelligent Conversations. I'm your host, Chance Glenn. We've been having a great and fascinating conversation with Professor Marilyn Breaux, and she is a professor at RIT, and we're going to talk more about your professorship and all the what actually got you to that point in a second. Let me just remind the listeners that Intelligent Conversations is a podcast available on iTunes. You can subscribe to it by going to iTunes and pushing the button there and doing whatever you have to subscribe, and you will get each show as it's uploaded on a weekly basis. Now, what I also would like for you to do is to visit our Facebook page at Intelligent Conversations, interact with us there, participate in some of the questions and postings and updates that we have. We are starting to build up our listeners and those who are interacting with us, so it should be fun. And finally, our website is where you can get the shows directly. You can read about our guests and just find out more about the show and what our purpose is there on the website. The website is also home and helps us on our affiliate program, a sponsor. Our sponsor is Amazon.com. And you can help us there by going there and just clicking on Amazon.com, starting with our page, and then doing your normal online shopping there. You get great deals on Amazon.com. Many of the books and the suggested readings that we have on the show are available through there, as well as just the good old commercial things that you would purchase. You can get just about anything there. When you go there and shop, starting at our page, it helps us, and this is going to help us expand the show. So if you would help us do that. Okay, I want to get back to the conversation we were having. And so, Marilyn, I just want to find out, you were talking about your high school experience and some of the influence. You mentioned a little bit about your undergraduate experience and some of the people that influenced you. So how did that continue, and how did that continue on to graduate school and eventually on to a professorship?
Terrific love of literature from the only non-Jesuit teacher I had at St. Louis University, a small Italian man, Al Montesi. I still adore him. He died in the last few years. Mm. He left, by the way, a bequest to all of his students out of his will. How sad for him.
Wow.
But he gave us a love for American literature, whether it was Huck Finn, whatever he taught, we loved it, and I was hooked then. By the time I got to graduate school, I thought I would be a medievalist because I'd had a lot of philosophy and Latin and found it really interesting, the kind of Gawain and the Green Knight stories in medieval literature. And did an MA in medieval, but then fell into modernism really hard when I picked up on poets like Sylvia Plath. And that, of course, was my first book. And I had an amazing number of prestigious faculty who came through University of Connecticut at that time. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking Charles Olson. I was in one of his last classes.
Okay.
He only took people on for 2 years or four semesters. Well, he didn't live to finish it out. Stephen Spender, the poet from England, who would visit Connecticut.
Okay.
And a number of very powerful, impressive people there at Connecticut in those years. So I was hooked in literature, but not not so thoroughly that I couldn't look laterally and read as I do now things like Wired and New Scientist and whatever.
Sure.
So.
Okay. So that took you through your graduate education. And you did your, what your PhD was in what? And what's your
Actually, that was in modernism, but also in modern poetry.
Okay.
So that was my first book. My dissertation was the first book that I published on Sylvia Plath, Protean Poetic.
Okay, okay.
Seems so long ago now, 30 years or something.
Yeah, well, you know, it's that's the foundation you build on.
Yeah.
So, at that point, did you know that you wanted to move towards academia? Was that your goal all along?
Part of it is you're seduced. You're given the right to go on to the next step.
Mm-hmm.
And I was an NDEA scholar in graduate school. So
okay.
I kept getting rewards and awards.
Right.
So they were almost at that point unthinking. It was just the next step available. But then at a certain point, when you're looking for your first job and it's a tight market, you face, you know, the wolf, you say, is this really what I want to do? I had an amazing opportunity not to teach composition somewhere as a first job, but to go to Notre Dame University as the first woman faculty, non-religious woman faculty, and to teach in a program of nonviolence and to teach in freshman seminar, which is like a great book series for which they have another bookend. When you're a senior, you take collegiate seminar.
Right.
But this was the first year freshman seminar. So that was my first teaching job, quite an amazing two affiliations at Notre Dame. And at that time, there were people like the Berrigans coming through and Howard Zinn and Iqbal Ahmed, and scholars who were very impressive.
Right.
The irony was that the whole program was funded by Gulf Oil.
Okay.
But it was an amazing first teaching experience. So you can see where I'm progressively more and more hooked. And it was wonderful to be there in those years.
Okay. So how long did you spend there?
I spent 4 years there.
Right.
I came there ABD, all but dissertation, finished my graduate exams and my dissertation while I was there.
Okay.
And then moved on to my first job in 1974, first full-time job at SUNY Binghamton, now Binghamton University.
Okay.
In the English department, and that too was pretty challenging because women's studies was just getting started then.
Yeah.
And I had colleagues like Elizabeth Fox Genovese and others. Very interesting time to be there.
Okay, so when did you join RIT?
I came to RIT. Actually, I had an endowed chair in the Midwest.
Okay.
If you'd like a little personal story.
Sure,
I went to Grinnell College in order to take care of my mother, who was within a couple of hundred miles, and managed to do that for 14 years.
Okay.
I went there in 86 and left in 2002.
All right.
So I came to RIT after holding the Louise Rosenfield Noun Chair at Grinnell College, where I was also given the right to build a wonderful series and some modules and courses in gender and women's studies.
Okay.
And very exciting time. And came here in 2002 to chair both English and foreign languages, which then had 38 people under one chair. So, speaking of challenges.
Yes. Now, also, you know, coming here to a place that, you know, in the title is an Institute of Technology.
Yeah.
The focus being on, you know, sciences and technology particularly. What were your thoughts about that?
My thoughts were, what an amazing kind of energy here. Mm. And that's what really drew me, Chance, was not only Andrew Moore's sweet-talking.
But I know a little bit about
you
that.
You know a little bit about that. But an amazing kind of energy and exhilaration everywhere. Sometimes a little bit at cross-purposes, but most of the time just an experience I hadn't had at other schools.
Okay, I see that. Now, so let's talk a little bit about your research, your work. What is it that drives you, and what have you been immerse yourself in?
Well, since 2006, I've had probably the best experience of my whole 40-some year career building Visionaries in Motion, the Gannett Project, Visionaries in Motion, and not doing it solo, alone, but doing it with a working group of seven people around me. I'm the seventh, six around me, drawn from all over the Institute.
So tell me about that. What's the concept of this?
The concept is that we are all committed to not single disciplinary speakers, not who we know and can bring from some paper we've given somewhere, but to reading widely, to looking at who some of the most exciting, truly visionary people who work in a number of different disciplines themselves, what they might bring to our IT students. And we've had, as you know, an amazing success with the series from not just the big names like Ray Kurzweil and the bad boy of graphic design, Stefan Sagmeister, or Elizabeth Streb, or Dr. Lee Hood, who founded systems biology. But we've had people who maybe are less well-known, but who've turned out to be just blockbuster drawing people. They've come, they've done interviews with Bob Smith. They've done interviews with our students because we've run a course around the series called Visionaries in Motion, where students can sit and have lunch with and interview people like Ray Kurzweil or Stefan Sagmeister or Dan Ariely, behavioral economist, and be videotaped interviewing them and then be posted online. So all that's there on our website.
Okay. And that's available at, what's the easiest way to get it?
CWGP. It's just the initials for Caroline Werner Gannett, CWG, and then project, CWGP.org.
Okay.
And I'll get you right there.
And I'll make sure the link is available on our site under your photo and everything else about you.
That's lovely.
We put there. All right.
That's
so we'll keep that kind of thing going. Because in a small way, that's, what the idea for this show is to connect with people and talk about things that are important and talk about the things that motivate them.
What's been really important to this working group, Chance, is that we don't all, any one of us, get our way in bringing somebody to the table. For every 11 or 12 speakers whom we vet, and by vetting we read, we look at videos, YouTubes, we end up choosing one. And our choices have been MacArthur Award winners, TEDsters, people with huge international awards. And here's the magic. We do not go through agents. Only three times that I can recall we've had to, in the end, go through someone's agent. But that's out of years since 2006.
Okay.
So that's quite amazing.
So you reach out directly to
we develop a personal relationship with the person who then comes to campus, and it always pays off so much more than it would if we had just gone through an agency and, written up a contract or something.
Well, in that regard, maybe you can help me connect with more
I would happily do
and
that.
Speakers on for this show. As I said earlier, I really want to expand the ideas of what we're talking about, because I think it's important. It's just important to just have these kind of conversations and let people hear them and think about things and talk about things that they might not have done before.
And what has helped us do that is the diversity of people's disciplines and affiliations in the group. We had for a long time someone from the community. We have a student. We have someone in bioinformatics or biology. We had a physicist, imaging science, photography, NTID. So by bringing these multiple disciplines together, no one has the same perspective as the person next to them. So we're forever debating, discussing, doing challenging talk.
Well, that's the foundation of it. That's really, really good. So we're going to make sure that that's available. And as I see their video there, there's all kind of things there for people to participate in. So we're going to make sure we push that through our avenues and bring more people connected. And that's what it's all about. Okay, we're running up on time for another break. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to take this break here. And when we come back, I want to talk about some of the books you've written, some of the things you have in mind for upcoming things.
Sure.
And then I want to kind of ask you some broader questions about life and, you know, global society and things like that. All right, so get ready
answer
for that.
I can answer on cancel. I'll do my best.
All right, well, great. All right, so we'll be, this is Intelligent Conversations. Okay, we are back for our third and final segment of Intelligent Conversations. This week, I have the great fortune of having Dr. Mary Lynn Breaux in the studio. We've been having a tremendous talk about a lot of different things. And in this particular case, we are kind of expanding the what we're talking about for the whole picture of Intelligent Conversations, and I like it a lot. I hope that we can do more of this and just expand the ideas beyond just science and technology. These things that are important to life and society are greater than just those narrow views, and I really am not only want to welcome more guests this way, more listener, expand our listenership to the areas that we're talking about so that we can elevate the conversation higher and higher. And that, I'm looking forward to that, and I'm hoping that this year coming up, that's what this is going to be all about. Let me just do a little bookkeeping to remind you that we are available on iTunes, and you can subscribe to the show and therefore get all the shows as you as they're posted immediately through your iPhone or iPad or iTouch or i whatever you may have, and then you can also go to our website under ourintelligentconversations.com, and there you can see all the shows. You can go back in time and look at what we've had in the past, download them all if you like directly. And finally, I'd like you to visit our Facebook page and interact with us there. If you would also support us through our Amazon.com affiliate program, if you just essentially click on our webpage, click on Amazon and do your regular shopping there, that will help us a great deal. Okay, that's it for that. Now, let's get back to the conversation. And what I'd like to know is about some of the your writing, your publications, and you mentioned a book that you wrote for your essentially for your dissertation.
I never intended to market it. Somebody came to me and said, "Wow, you're working on Sylvia Plath."
Yeah.
And it probably turns out to be have been the first book on Plath.
Yeah.
But it was not Plath in her context so much as the world within the word, you know, the poetry. So I like to look at that first book, 81, and look at my new work now, which is Salons and Cultural Modernism, you know, as kind of the trajectory of where I've moved. In between, there has been a book on Juno Barnes and her world, both overseas, expatriate modernist world, and world in Greenwich Village in the teens and 20s.
Okay.
And after, there have been two books of letters, one published in Germany and one in Italy, of women expatriate modernists who didn't have the talking cure or Abilify or anything that people have today, but they had the right to create sometimes 14-page letters to each other, to spill their soul and their world and their culture to each other. So I took a group of those letters between 34 and 38, very important years, and published them both in Italy and in Germany. And they're pretty amazing to women, Juno Barnes and Emily Holmes Coleman.
Now, were these letters to each other?
They were exchanged back and forth, but they included this enlarging kind of world of writers and artists, sculptors, you know, journalists, all of their friends.
So what is the nature of some of the letters? Give me an example.
Terrible. 14-page, single-spaced letters that move from gossipiness about the world they live in, the sort of ear to the ground stuff you wouldn't know otherwise, to some real ideas about publication and where they're going with the things they're writing and who's looking at it, whether T.S. Eliot's reading this manuscript or somebody else is reading another one. So they range. When you have 14 pages of single-spaced letters, it's each letter, and they'd sometimes write each other every day, every other day.
Yeah.
So quite amazing letters.
Interesting. Now, what drew you to them?
I'm an old haunter of archives. I mean, one of the things I'm going back to this next year is stuff I did 30 years ago at the Yale Beinecke, at the Harry Ransom Center, and at Southern Illinois University, Morris Library. The collections there of a lot of the people from this world of the first 20, 30 years in British and American culture. And I put my ear to the ground there and came into archives just being donated. They hadn't been accessioned yet. I'd put on my white gloves. I'd go to a box and I'd start poking through it like a sleuth, like a detective. And, you know, find some amazing things that revolutionized our thinking about certain writers and artists. And where that has led me is to the big new book that'll take a few years to finish, but a book on literary salons, cultural salons.
What do you mean by that?
Groups of people, not just a lone modernist like an Ernest Hemingway with his relationship with Max Perkins, his editor, but what happened when people got together in social circumstances and talked to each other and were working on certain things in certain years with each other. What kind of mutual influences did they have? How did they spur or deter one another's work?
Do you have an idea of who you might be focusing
on? I'll probably start with Mabel Dodge Lewin, a Buffalo, New York girl, and look at her salon in Florence in about 1910, Villa Coronia, and then move to her salon in Greenwich Village a few years later, a very different salon. I'll look at Natalie Barney, an heiress from the United States who went over to France and founded the Temple of Friendship, where women would come and do readings and share stuff with each other. And then I'd go to Caress Crosby, who founded the first paperback press, the Black Sun Press, and she had a wonderful old mill that belonged to Rousseau in France. And she brought people like Hart Crane together with Charles Olson and others. So I'll look at the intersection of people. Buckminster Fuller was there. Look at the intersection of people and what their exchanges were. Now, this is intensive research. It means looking at their letters, looking at their chapbooks, their memoirs, other people's letters about them. And then I'll probably end up with Louise Bourgeois, an artist, a sculptor who died just this year at 98, who had a salon in New York City.
Now I've got to ask you, because as you're talking about these things, and you're talking about this kind of social connections, what is your take on the new social media and this same type of interaction that you're talking about that now occurs on this grander scale? A lot more people, but it is a vehicle for thought and exchanging of ideas. What's your take on this?
It's an amazing vehicle for exchange of ideas, and I wish I were more into things like Facebook and Twitter. I'm not. I'm on iPad. So, but I'm watching a phenomenon out there that can ignite an Arab Spring, that can enable things that are happening in safe houses for women in Afghanistan. There's an immense power. I think it's as yet unharnessed. And I think there's going to be a lot of talk yet among Facebook, Google, Amazon, and others, you know, the Jeff Bezos is the others in the world. There's going to be a lot of talk that still goes on. But it's a power. And it's a tool.
Okay. Well, and that's how I see it, as you're describing this salons, as you're talking about, is that Is that the same kind of idea? You're talking about people getting together and exchanging ideas and talking about their world around them. Is that the idea?
It'll be interesting to raise that question as I move toward very contemporary times in the book. I think there are digital salons right now that occur and that do such things. But, you know, I'm looking at a slightly different phenomenon because it's a matter of who's invited, who shows up. Rather than something more democratically available.
I understand. Now, looking at the world that we're living in, and it's we see instances of upheavals and changes, and then we have a lot of status quo as well. What do you think, if there is a singular important change that must happen, can happen, will happen, do you see, can you identify something like that that is, you know, extremely important that has to happen?
If we can use a word like contrarian, it assumes much more importance than a right or a left or a traditional political party on either of those sides, if you will, or boundaries. I think that the boundaries are completely broken down by a willful, almost contrarian nature of some of the things going on now in Occupy.
Okay, so
Wall Street.
Now, contrarian implies that there is a aversion to the status quo. Okay, so. Is that what you're saying, that the status quo is not good enough?
Not listening.
Efficient?
Not listening.
Okay, that's a good point. So not listening. And yes, I think that that's very, very important. I try not to wax too political in these conversations. I'm a person, I hope for people, I want to see people connected together. I want people to listen to each other and do the things that are, you know, good for everyone. It doesn't seem that there's any particular party that you can assign yourself to that does it. The Democrats try, but they're so spread out and in many cases unfocused about some of these things that that's hard. Republicans, in my opinion, have a particular agenda that they're working that agenda strongly, and that's what they do. But they're not listening, as you say. And Democrats are not listening. And it's just like, you know, collectively, you know, American people are trying to shake them and say, listen to what we think is important. And it's just like, no, we just want to fight and continue to gain power, and all right, you get the presidency this time, and you get it next time. It, you know, just that thing.
And we block this now, and we negotiate that then.
Yeah,
it's a mess right now.
So now you're saying this contrarian view, it's being elevated, but what's the end game?
I think it's pretty formative right now. I don't think there is an answer to that right now. I think it's going to emerge. I think the more we can have things like your intelligent conversations and do those across people's specific areas of expertise and interest, the more we're going to chisel away at those edges, make them a little ragged, make them a little serrated, so that something, a little porous, so that something gets in, using my bad metaphors here.
No, it's a good one, because, you know, that's, you talk about friction, right? Friction.
Yes.
Friction has to do with the fact that there are a jagged type of uneven connections between two surfaces. The smoother the surface is, the less friction there is.
Mm-hmm.
But friction creates things. Friction creates heat and energy.
That's right.
Energy is generated through friction. Smooth, almost, because if something's so smooth that they don't even generate any type of friction, it's like one doesn't matter to the other.
That's exactly the right? point. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So I get what you're saying by creating those. Just like we're doing now. I mean, some of the things you're talking about, some of the authors and the people, I'm not familiar with.
No, I'm sitting here in front of your wonderful books, Electronic Design and yeah. Introductory Circuit Analysis, and I'm thinking, awesome.
Isn't it funny? All right, so I've used these books to prop up the microphone to get it closer to you. So you're kind of speaking on that foundation.
I am speaking on it.
but it's funny. But and I'm a little bit uncomfortable with the topics that you're discussing, but it's drawn me to want to know more and to elevate my thinking over into those areas. And I think that's the kind of thing, as you're talking about this show, the Intelligent Conversations, that can be one of the things that we try to do. And I hope that that's the way we continue to go, and we continue to have guests of a very broad spectrum that draws, people who are interested in science and technology and all that stuff also gets drawn to the humanities and the arts.
And this is the place. This is the venue, RIT, where mm-hmm. that is possible, more mm-hmm. so than any place I've been in 40 years. There are boundary-breaking exercises such as this.
And opportunities
that are unusual here.
Yeah.
And run with them.
Yeah. So, and that's one of the good things I think about being a professor. If you can find the resources, you can do just about anything you want to. And that's one of the things I try to do to keep my creative part alive. And so that's what the purpose is. Now, it's been great talking to you.
Thank you,
James. There's a lot of things that we could continue to talk about. I hope we don't stop talking. I mean, I got to know you briefly in another situation, but I hope we can continue to talk. You invited me to a couple of these things that are coming up with Visionaries in Motion. You mentioned some of the people that come around and you go out and spend time with them. So I want to expand myself in that regard.
And I mean, they're utterly unusual people, none from a single discipline like humanities and technology mm-hmm. or something. Mm-hmm. We started, with an award-winning physicist, mm-hmm. Esther Conwell, who crosses both a chemistry and a physics department. Yeah. And just received the National Medal of Science for her work in conductive properties.
Okay, yeah.
And then we had a man who's been blind since age 15, but who's a memoirist, journalist, and screenwriter, come from Canada. And we had the former editor of the New York Times, Fred Richin, New York Times photography section, come, professor of imaging, photography and imaging at NYU. We now have, coming up December 8th, a biomedical animator who is a MacArthur Award winner from Australia.
Yeah.
So you're picking up on this international connection, but also multidisciplinary connection for every single speaker. Our capstone person is coming up, Sebastian Sung, on February 2nd, professor of computational neuroscience at MIT and also at the Howard Hughes Institute.
Well, I'm interested in that, too.
Oh, he's a terrifically compelling speaker. And then Charles Burns, who the students all love because he's done cartoons like Deep Hole or X'd Out and Black Hole and Skin Deep. And David Bornstein, who is founded Dowser.org and writes a column for the New York Times on Are We on the Verge of a New Enlightenment?
Yeah, that's
and ending up with a marble sculptor, a MacArthur Award-winning marble sculptor who makes marble look like lace.
Okay. Wow. So I'm going to get more involved in that almost because if something's so smooth that they don't even generate any type of friction, is it like one doesn't matter to the other?
That's exactly the point. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So I get what you're saying by creating those. Just like we're doing now. I mean, some of the things you're talking about, some of the authors and the people, I'm not familiar with.
No, I'm sitting here in front of your wonderful books, Electronic Design and Introductory Circuit Analysis, and I'm thinking, awesome.
Isn't it funny? All right, so I've used these books to prop up the microphone to get it closer to you. So you're kind of speaking on that foundation.
I am speaking on it.
but it's funny. I'm a little bit uncomfortable with the topics that you're discussing, but it's drawn me to want to know more and to elevate my thinking in over into those areas. And I think that's the kind of thing that, as you're talking about this show, the Intelligent Conversations, that can be one of the things that we try to do. And I hope that that's the way we continue to go, and we continue to have guests of a very broad spectrum that draws, you know, people who are interested in science and technology and all that stuff also gets drawn to the humanities and the arts.
And this is the place.